is going to be Dean Epler of Johnson Space Center. He has a nine colleagues that were involved in this. It shows up on his lead slide, so I won't read all those names, but I will read the title of the presentation. It's Apollo Constellation Geologic Training Workshop, Reviewing Apollo's Accomplishments and Preparing for a New Generation of Geologic Explorers for Lunar Field Geology. So, Dean Epler.
I want to apologize to the first and third speakers for being so well-dressed. If anybody wants to borrow my jacket, you're certainly welcome to. This is to discuss the results of a workshop we held at JSC, actually at the LPI, in April, which actually came out of a discussion that Mark Helper and I had a number of years ago at a league meeting, where we tried to get some Apollo guys to come in and tell us how they taught the crew, and unfortunately Mark didn't have any money to get them to come, so we had kind of a sparse turnout. And it occurred to me that since Time Zero is working on everybody in this room at roughly the same rate, we had to get these guys as soon as possible. So I decided we needed to have a workshop, and with the help of the SAGES program at JSC, was able to fund this. In addition to that, we are in the process of selecting a new astronaut class, and the announcement for that class stated that the crews would be potentially involved in lunar missions. Dwayne Ross, who both runs the astronaut selection program and the training program for the astronaut candidates, and I decided that was the camel's nose under the tent in order to initiate a redevelopment of the curriculum for the crew members, which hasn't changed since 1978. So we sort of took that as our charge, and this workshop consisted of as many of the Apollo guys as we could get, plus a number of people that we pulled in from academia who have a record of excellence in teaching to start doing this new curriculum. And so what I'm going to do is the twofold, and Gary Lofgren is probably going to do a little bit more data on the Apollo experience. The geologic training for the Apollo guys really can be stated in essentially that first bullet. It was to teach the crew members to think and act like geologists in the field, regardless of whether the field was someplace terrestrially or someplace on the moon. There's a whole host of training emphases that they pursued, but it was largely problem solving, description, and communication. People say, geez, you know, these guys did really well. It's pretty surprising since Jack was the only professional geologist. But the fact is, if you look at what the other 11 crew members did, they were test pilots, and test pilots, in effect, are scientists in airplanes, and whose job is to figure out what the airplane does and get back on the ground in one piece and report it to people. So what we were trying to do is take that those observational skills and apply it to a different problem. One other key part of this is that it wasn't just the crew members, it was the crew, the guy that would be talking to them on the lunar surface, the flight director, and the folks in the back room, to train them as a consistent team so that everybody knew everybody else's nuances and really understood when a particular crew member said something, what they really meant, because you'd been in the field with them, you'd done simulations with them, so that everybody had a sense of what was going on. And then lastly, once you knew what you were doing, practice, practice, practice. Fred Hertz has told me that they practiced the sampling procedure to the point where the crew members didn't even need to use checklists anymore. They just got out and did it because it was second nature. That you could have woken them up from a dead sleep and said, do this, and they would have done it. One of the interesting things, this exciting and dynamic slide shows, is that on the y-axis is the number of locations in the West. This is the number of geologists, and these are the trips that were taken. This is a tremendous amount of training, particularly in light of how we do training now on station and shuttle. Particularly when you consider most of these were not in Houston, since we don't have any geology in Houston per se. And that each one of these, besides the cast of geologists, involved support personnel, PAO guys, the whole bit. It was like taking a movie crew out once a month for months and months and months on end. The other thing interesting is in many cases, the last trip in the field was within a month of launch. And that was pretty gutsy because you were taking these guys to folks where, or these folks to places where they could potentially break a leg or get hit with a rock or something. And a month before flight, people tend to get really spooky about messing with the prime crew. So this training program represents a tremendous commitment by NASA management to do a good job on the moon. It also represents a tremendous commitment by a number of these people. I think George Ulrich, you can't quite see it on the bottom, but this is sort of how many trips any individual did. George Ulrich did 23 trips, and having done enough travel in my life, he deserves some sort of medal for that. This is a good example of the kind of training the crew members did. This is what the Apollo 15 crew had when they were sitting on the pad getting ready to launch, and the 16 and 17 crew had much the same experience. 1,037 hours of training over the course of, partly over the course of their entire astronaut career, but most of this came in the 2 years that they were, after they were assigned to the crew. And they, I remember when I was a kid listening to missions, they said these guys had master's degrees in geology, and they were right. That's a lot of training, and it's reflected in the results from the mission. What they did in the field was twofold. Some of the training trips were standard, just like you go out in the field with students, or if you're a student, when you go out in the field with your professors, you're out there with your hammer and jeans and things like that. But a number of the trips, particularly as the mission was getting close to flying, were full-up integrated simulations of what the crew would do on the lunar surface, including mock-ups of the life support systems, the tools, the comm gear so they could talk to somebody who would record and listen and critique their performance, sunglasses so you knew what the rocks actually looked like when you had your visor down as opposed to visor up. And they were full-up dress rehearsals for what was going on in the field. Some of the later ones, actually, they were talking to folks in Houston. In addition to the crew and the trainers, they had at least some of the flight directors out, some of the ops personnel. So the bottom line is everybody knew what was going on, and it was critical to how things worked. You had a back room, in this case, Bill Mulberger and Tony Englund, and I don't remember who that guy is, but that's out at Sudbury. And again, the instructors were there, and the folks got critiqued. These were not get up, hit in the field at 9, come back and start drinking beer at 4. These were out at the crack of dawn, do one run, critique it, do another run, critique it. You know, they were intense, very, very, very long mission, long training trips. The lessons learned, and again, Gary, I think, is going to go over this in more detail, but your lead trainer has to be fired up. If the lead trainer's fired up, the crew members, regardless of whether they're engineers or geologists, get fired up too. The training has to proceed in a manner similar to a graduate seminar. I've heard several of personal experiences where the crew members had a very, very sharp BS filter, and if they thought they smelled something that didn't sound right, they went in for the kill. You were talking about guys that were at the top of their field, real cocky, and weren't afraid to call out inconsistencies. The other thing is that each mission was based on a consistent team of trainers, crew members, and flight control personnel who worked together through the entire mission sequence. I say here they were with the crew through splashdown, but the fact is that the trainers went after splashdown and participated in the debrief, so that everybody that worked together as a team for 2-plus years on this mission. It took a minimum of 2 years to get everybody ready to go and do the work that they did. This wasn't a quick, guys, we got to fly next week. It was a consistent training for 2 years. They did a lot of good geology in different places. The moon and the Earth in some ways are very dissimilar, but I think it's a good example of how well they were trained that when the Apollo 16 crew got to Descartes, having been told there were going to be volcanic domes and ash flows and found nothing but breccias, had the training and the wherewithal to say, guys, this isn't what we told us it was going to be there. I've heard discussions about they went and did what they thought was right because they had the training and got arguments all the way through the mission until they got back down to the ground when the guys on the ground said, wow, it really is all a bunch of branches. How about that? So that's an example of how well these guys were trained, that they got in the field, saw something different, and it didn't fluster them. They just picked up the ball and ran with it like they'd been on any training exercise. Each field trip has to be organized around a number of basic elements, the training objectives, a chain of command where one guy is in charge of the training and in charge of getting it done. The logistics and science planning beforehand has to be good. Anybody who's ever led a field trip knows if you don't have the guidebooks, if the beer isn't on the outcrop, everybody gets grumpy. So logistics is really important. Getting local experts involved, doing a pre-trip recon, and sufficient on-site support for all the training equipment used. Back when I showed you the picture of the guys doing the joint sim, you know, the radios had to work because the guys you were talking to were, you know, a mile away. If the radios didn't work, you were kind of down in the dumps for that one. So the simulations were the key to how this worked. By the time the crew members got to the field on these missions, it was just another training exercise in a sense. They may be on the moon, they may be in pressure garments, but the bottom line is they'd done this before, and that's sort of the key to all training like this, is you do it often enough and in a realistic manner that when people get to the real thing, they almost don't know it's the real thing, it's just another exercise. The whole thing was run by a science planning panel, which had a big cheese running it, and this really worked because from my experience in various other big programs in NASA, you tend to get into a situation, if somebody isn't running the train, where you get people saying, my science is better than your science. And you need a strong person to manage the mission and manage the science so that the overall science return is good. We had two crew members that participated in this workshop. Both of them, particularly Alan Bean, said they really enjoyed the training, and one of their frustrations was when they got to the lunar surface, they were so rushed and had so little time, they often felt like they didn't have a chance to really take all that training and be geologists on the lunar surface. We will hopefully have more time to do this stuff on Constellation, but we won't entirely be free of that. Now, I want a quick run through the training curriculum, or an example of it. We took the NASA Advisory Council objectives and used those as the driving points for what we were training the crews to do. We did that, one, because it gave a foundation, and two, because if I have a manager come to me and say, why are we teaching the crew this, I can always point back to a NAC objective, and it's clear why we're doing it. This eye chart is an example. We have a NAC objective here, which has to do with the lunar crust. This devolves into high-level training objectives, subjects further and further down, and a list of places where we could go do this kind of training. We felt that the training for the next generation has to proceed in depth, starting with the astronaut candidate year. So what we were doing is writing the curriculum for the first year. We decided that the field is the best trainer. So field training has to be the focus, but it does proceed more efficiently when there's a back room of classroom material. So we were trying to put something together that would, in fact, show a combination of field and classroom activities. This is an example of how you could tackle this particular set of objectives, the classroom training subjects, the activities, than the field activities that proceed from the classroom activities. And by the way, we included, quote, field work in the lunar curatorial facility at Johnson. We have lunar samples now, so we can take the opportunity to get the crew members spun up on lunar samples right from the start. Another example is for the lab techniques. We don't yet know what the crew will be doing on the surface when we go back in terms of laboratory operations, so we need to understand some of that. Even if we don't do a lot of lab techniques in the field, we giving them the background to see what you do in the lab will inform how they do their sample collection in the field. Again, going to Building 31 as a field trip as part of this. The proposed flow basically has a number of operations. We want to start with hitting them almost as soon as they get there. We're giving them an opportunity to go look at lunar rocks and hopefully talk to folks like Jack and get them fired up on why this is important. Then we want to have a field operation, a 2 to 3 day exercise in a geologically relevant terrain, pairing crew members with geologists and going around and mapping. Dedicated classroom work that will build on this and then build into this another field operation at least a week long. Traditionally, the crew members have been going to Taos, which Pat Dickerson has been critically involved with, both doing the geology and the geophysics. And we want to build on that, going back to Taos and spending time not only doing geophysics, but actually getting out and, again, field mapping, so we're getting them right into the middle of it. We also consider the astronaut candidate year just the start. We want to go then do what I call the phase one, which is after they get their astronaut candidate year done, and between the time they're sort of now real astronauts before they receive mission assignments, start to get them out in the field at least once a year for a week at a time, again, paired with geologists to do field mapping and start developing that ability to see and think in the field. And then once they're assigned to a lunar crew, I believe we should go into the kind of field flow that we did on Apollo, starting with basic stuff and going up to joint integrated sims. The last open issues, one is identifying the trainers. When we did this on Apollo, the primary trainers came from the USGS at Flagstaff and Building 31 at JSC. At that time, both of those organizations were staffed by people that had a tremendous amount of field experience. In the intervening 30 years, those two organizations have evolved away from solid field experience. People have some background, but not a lot. And they're geochemists and remote sensors. And I think the place we got to go grab those people is in academia, as well as in the survey and other places. The other thing is, of course, funding the training. Gary, I think, took some umbrage when I said they had unlimited budgets. I know they didn't have unlimited budgets, but they had a hell of a lot more money than we'll probably have to get all that operating. So finding the money, getting it allocated so that people recognize this is an important thing to do is going to be really critical. And I think that's my last slide. Any questions?
Yeah, we have time for at least one question before we go on. Yes, one.
Dean, I was just wondering, both during Apollo and in your planning phase now, how much effort was put into plans if something breaks? So if one of the guys' cameras doesn't work, how do you change your documentation style and things like that?
We didn't really hit on that much. That's kind of more toward the mission-specific training, but it's a critical part of all this. Being able to fake it when things don't work right is really critical. That gets more into the basic ops, and we were trying to concentrate on the basic geology, but that's a good point.
Yeah. Not all.
Okay.
Take that off. That is the stupidest thing NASA ever did with respect to the astronaut corps, was to have candidate astronauts. These guys have been selected, they've gone through the process, and it even has hurt NASA in a very fundamental way to have a group of people that you don't use as astronauts. That's sort of outside the sense of this meeting, but please don't reinforce that.
Okay.
I've been trying to get those guys in the bill for 30 years.
Thank you, Dean, and thank you for the contributions from the audience. We're going to move on to paper number 3. I just remind you that paper number 4 is canceled, so we'll probably be right on track. So.